Blog Talk Radio.
And greetings, Ma'ahotep. Welcome to another segment of New Day, Resurrection, and Liberation.
What young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro, back during slavery. There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food when he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save the master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, the master said, "We got a good house here." The house Negro said, "Yeah, we got a good house here." Whenever the master said "we," he said "we." That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick. We sick." He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, "Let's run away, let's escape, let's separate," that house Negro would look at you and say, "Man, you crazy. What do you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this?" That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here.
And again, greetings. Welcome to another segment of New Day, Resurrection and Liberation. My name is Empress Chi. And of course, this is Million Woman March Week. We are moving forward with our movement that we started 21 years ago. And now we are bringing forward something that has been worked on all that time. And we had to kind of keep it under wraps for a while because we saw just how much of a problem, shall we say, it's going to be for a lot of people. And as a result, there are many, many kinds of things that we had to endure, and we have. With that said, it is certainly our pleasure and honor to bring to you A Million Black Women Rising, a federation, not just an organization, but a federation. And of course, it is one of the official arms of the Million Woman March Universal Movement. Okay, we kicked off tonight, of course, with none other than Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, and certainly you know him as our brother, our black shining prince, Malcolm X. And he talked about, of course, the house Negro and the field Negro and some other things that certainly is so very relevant today. Tonight we're going to salute, as we have for the past few months, really, this being the 50-year anniversary commemoration of the Black Power Conference that took place here in Philadelphia. We kind of began not only commemorating and acknowledging it, but also putting some things in place with what we call Black Power 50-50. Black Power 50-50 for us is, again, to examine the last 50 years, to see what happened, how it happened, why it happened, to really now do an in-depth kind of analysis and embracing, but also to prepare for the next 50 years, because we've got to make certain that we not only continue the work that was started, but that we now really move forward in the type of victorious manner that is necessary for today. And so next year there will be a Black Power 50-50 summit. With that, we call it Black Power and Black Consciousness, because we're combining these ideas, these concepts, and bringing it into the 21st century. And note, doing it from a frame of reference that does not necessarily link us to or put us in the position of religion or other kinds of ideology. I know, you know, some people like, you know, Marxism and all these other things, and all that is fine. But we're looking at bringing forward our spirit, our energy, based on the really pureness, the simplicity, but at the same time, the real essence of being Black. And, hey, I know, you know, for some that's debatable. You know, for some they don't even want to identify with that. And that's okay. Just like in philosophy, in mathematics, in psychology, there's so many different aspects and realms of it. There's so many different components to it. In psychology, you have behavioral psychology. You have, you know, abnormal psychology. You have so many different realms of any type of discipline or thing that is considered of some significance. So, you know, what I'm saying is that we're not talking about this being the all in all, the absolute or anything like that. What we're saying is here's something that, for those who feel they want to be involved or part of it or whatever, here it is, without all this other stuff connected to it. But best believe it will have everything that it needs to have. Again, our focus is spirituality, not religion. We encourage people to, you know, to be and do and whatever it is that makes them comfortable, makes them happy, or whatever it is. But that's not going to be something that we're going to be putting out in the forefront like that. Do we believe in a higher being? Absolutely. But at the same time, our position is more about do what it is you believe. Don't talk about it. I mean, you know, that's good that we can, and I'm sure we will from time to time, but that's not the major focus. The major focus is the work, the actual work. And in this day and age, obviously, we've got a lot of that to do, given the fact that you go to any city, and for the most part, you can count on one hand, if that many, independent institutions that are solely running adequately, successfully, with and by Black folks, period. And here we are in the 21st century, and this is what we're looking at, and the bottom line is we've got to do better. And so, again, how is that going to happen? Well, with MWM, we have every intention of bringing that forward, and then some. And again, you know, we're just one of several. But certainly we're in it, okay? And, you know, again, we don't know of anything that has been of any significance that did not go through some form of trial and tribulation. And so, you know, hey, it is what it is. At any rate, tonight we again are going to look at and examine Black power. Black power in terms of, you know, why it was necessary. And we're going to be doing that for the course of the next year. But tonight we want to kind of look at it because yesterday we, of course, paid tribute to the Million Man March, it being the 23-year anniversary of it. And we did not mention that yesterday was also the anniversary that two serious Black men stood up and did something before the whole world. And again, when we talk about Black power, when we look at the types of things that people were doing, it wasn't just a conversation, it wasn't just a slogan, it wasn't just words. People were doing things. And so yesterday, October 16th, also marked the day that in 1968, 50 years ago, that John Carlos and Tommy Smith took that stand with their fists up in the air at the Olympics. I mean, that was just incredible to see. Of course, you know, some of us were too young to really see it and understand it and so forth, but certainly today, I mean, you can't help but to feel the pride, the greatness of that moment, or, you know, that type of stance. I got the opportunity to meet Tommy Smith a few years ago, Brother Tommy Smith, that is, Elder Tommy Smith, and certainly am looking forward to reconnecting with him again. As a matter of fact, we both received our honorary doctorates at the same presentation. And so, again, you know, I was really happy to be in that type of company, and certainly, again, look forward to not only meeting him again, but to, you know, build with him again. As a matter of fact, next year we will be paying tribute to Dr. Kwabi Nana Shanti, who, for some may know, the Willie Lynch letter. Well, he is said to be the actual person that wrote that letter. And so we will be paying tribute to him next year. His work, he has several books that he has written that are very, very powerful books. But also we're going to do a whole session on Willie Lynch, what it is, why it is, and how can we deprogram ourselves? How can we break that chip? How can we deactivate it? Okay. First, again, to really understand it, and certainly, I believe it was written initially like in 1970-something. So certainly, you know, we need to look at it today and do some revisions or what have you. And so we're going to do that. Now, that's just one of the things that the MWM Universal Movement is bringing forward with A Million Black Women Rising. And the other thing that we want to tell you about, talking about Black Power and Black History, a little later on we're going to talk with Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. I spoke with him a little while ago, and of course there is an emergency situation that is presently happening with Chairman Fred. He's going to tell you about it when he comes on in about 40 minutes or so. They're actually in a meeting right now, so when they finish the meeting in Chicago, he will be calling. The MWM entity as a organization, as a movement, over these past 20 years has really watched and examined some things that, you know, have been not only very problematic and troubling, but, you know, we had to take the time to really do some evaluation and assessment and as such to figure out what were we going to do about some of these things. One of the things we realized, of course, is that our history and many of our communities, we not only are not getting access to history from a national, international, world, antiquity, and even contemporary perspective, we also are not getting our history as it pertains to the local kinds of things that go on in our communities. That stuff is getting like totally dismissed, tossed to the side, and so forth. And so what we now realize is that we have to make certain that we institutionalize components that will enable us to document, archive, and so forth, the history in our communities. And so we began that process here. Of course, this past summer, we paid tribute to Father Paul Washington, who, of course, was the one who enabled the Black Power Conference to take place here in Philadelphia in 1968. It happened at his church, the Church of the Advocate. But Father Paul was also a very, very powerful freedom fighter in many other regards. And so, again, we learned that his papers, many of his letters, many of you know, the various kinds of photos and articles and things of that nature have, in fact, been archived under the Charles Bloxon Library, which is on and at the campus of Temple University. I never knew that existed until we started doing the research. We also did not know Father Paul's position on reparations until we started doing the research. But what we realized is that this information is not readily available. You have to really be into research to try to get some of this stuff, and so we did. But here's the point. The point is that we are now in the process of looking how to obtain our own building so that we can, in fact, house, archive, document, and have our information available to our people. And so once we duplicate it here in Philadelphia, we look at doing it in other cities. But this is just one of the things that MWM has worked on over the years, and that is, again, to examine what is going on in that, what has gone on in our communities, what is presently going on, and what is it that we need to do about it. And so with that said, we have and will be presenting our black print to the public. We have kind of done internally to some degree, but now we will be presenting the black print to the general public. Starting next week, we do a press briefing, a community information session. At that point, begin to put those pieces in place. So that's some of what we're going to talk about tonight, family. Again, we're going to talk with Chairman Fred Hampton very, very shortly. And let's see, I was trying to find a clip from Chairman Fred Hampton that was clear. There's several, but there's a particular one that I was looking for. The Chairman Fred Hampton Sr., that is. Again, we're going to have Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. on very, very shortly. And again, he's going to tell us about something that we've talked about previously, and that is the issue of gentrification. But in this particular situation, it's a little maybe deeper than just gentrification, which is happening all over the country. And again, we have to ask ourselves why, but we also have to ask ourselves, what are we going to do about it? Okay. And so with that said, I think I found the clip I was looking for, and I'm going to share that clip with you. Fred Hampton Jr. Oh no, Fred Hampton Sr. All right.
This is my son, Frederick Ted Jake Johnson Hampton. He was born December 29th, 1969, about 3 weeks after Fred was killed, his father. He's a senior at Children's High School. He does some rap, which is young people music. And he likes to draw his in the art and read. And I guess I kind of made him my reason for wanting to live. When he was born, although I was in the revolutionary spirit, I thought I wanted to see his birth. There's a fear there of seeing blood. And I was very protective of him from the moment he was born, like his father, he has a temper. There are a lot of mannerisms that his father had speaking. I noticed that when he was a baby, and it was really strange, kind of difficult to deal with. He reads a lot of things about his father, and occasionally he brings books home, pamphlets, and my, you've seen this? You know, this is something about the Black Panther Party. This is something about my dad.
Stop the trial. All power to the people. I just want to tell you that the chairman of the Black Panther Party is going to be engaged, and they're going to have to take those chains off him. But they're only going to have to do that if there's enough organization and if there's enough education and if enough people know about the chairman's place. And that's our job. That's what we're going to have to do. We're we're going to have to tell everybody in the world what's going on with him and Bobby. A lot of people reading the papers, every bus you get on, every building that you go into, they're talking about how cruel it is, the way they're treating him and Bobby Seale. And that's good, but what's not so good is that they don't understand that I have to tell this Bobby Seale to be me and you and everybody else.
Right.
Because when they even get to the stage of fascism, they've gotten to the stage where they're going to do anything that they think is necessary to force people that don't want to dig on the shit, that they're whooping on the people, they're going to force them to dig it. And they wouldn't even be doing this if it hadn't got to the stage like it is now. The thousands of people will come down to the Civic Center to denounce motherfuckers like Adolf and Hoffman and Mr. Me and Mr. and all these other factions running out of society. They wouldn't be down here now. And that's what we're down here for. Because we don't think that people that founded the Black Panther Party, the Liberation Party, the Vanguard Army for the revolutionary struggle on an international level, we don't think that's a person that's a criminal. As a matter of fact, we think that when Bobby Seale and Huey P. Newton got together in 1966, they got together as peacemakers, not as peacebreakers. They got together to deal with the peacemakers, peacebreakers. Peacebreakers like the pig, people that come in our community, occupy our territory like foreign territory, as they do all over the world.
We need some people out to defend their world and how to be armed. And there's nothing wrong with that. The only people who don't want you to have any guns are people who are getting to use guns on you. We said something funny about the guns in our community. We don't mind there being guns in our community, but we said there's been a distribution of our guns. For some reason or another, they have all the guns. And we relate to Jesse James, you know, and things like that. But when Jesse James was on the street, he said he didn't think about harassing Jesse James.
All of us need to do all that we can to stop this rise and tide of fascism. Because if we don't, we'll be in a situation similar to that situation that the Jewish people were in a few years ago. Now, we understand very clearly that they've shown by their actions that they, the establishment, intend to play the role that Germans play. We have to show them by our actions that we do not intend to play the role that the Jews play. When they got together, the European Union Bible deal, yes, they got together with God. There's nothing wrong with that. Because we need some God. Black people need some peace. Black people need some peace. And we are going to have to fight. We're going to have to struggle. We're going to have to struggle religiously to bring about some peace. Because the people that we have to perceive, they are a bunch of regular maniac warmongers.
He was killed so young. But he made so much of a contribution at an early age. It was an honor to hear him speak, really.
Okay, that of course was some excerpts from a presentation known as The People's History of Fred Hampton. And you kind of heard three voices there. Of course, one was the last one, the sister is Queen Afua. Of course, that's Fred Hampton Jr.'s mother, and of course the mate of Fred Hampton Sr. That was her in the background talking about Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. In some of his early years. You heard her kind of in the background doing some raps, but then after that, of course, you did hear the actual voice of Fred Hampton Sr.'s chairman, Fred Hampton Sr. It's important that we really hear and know and understand some of what was being said during that era. Again, when we look at Black Power, we can't just look at it in a vacuum or in one aspect. There's many, many dynamics, many levels of it. And so it's important that we understand and be able to analyze as much of it as possible, because there are some differences or some different aspects of it. Again, that was Chairman Fred Hampton Sr. And again, he was, of course, murdered, brutally assassinated by police cops in Chicago. And of course, in a few months, there will be a commemoration that Chairman Fred does every year in December, commemorating the assassination of his father and of course, another brother that was there as well. His mother was also there in the house at the time when the cops went into the home to do their criminal, I mean, beyond criminal, to do their acts of barbarism and everything else. Sister Queen Afua was there, and she was, of course, pregnant with Chairman Fred at that time. We're talking about this tonight because when Chairman Fred comes on, I'm just kind of giving you a little briefing. What has happened is the house, the home that he lives in, but it's also the family home that Chairman Fred Hampton Sr. grew up in, and his, you know, his parents and his siblings. That house is now, unfortunately, in foreclosure. And he will explain or give you some insight into how that happened. But in a few days, that house will be up for sale. It will go to auction or whatever they call it there, I believe October 23rd. So again, I want to play a little history or give you a little insight into some of the history of Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., of course, Queen Afua Hampton, and of course, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., and the importance of keeping that house for not only that family, but the legacy, the history of us as a people. That house has an important place in our history. And so, again, you know, he's going to come on shortly and share with you, you know, what exactly is happening now and how you, our people, can and must help at this time. This, of course, also lends to the whole issue of gentrification. And so all over the country, we are facing, you know, gentrification. And it's very interesting, family, and we have to begin to understand what's really going on with that because, and we talked about it briefly, I think, the other evening when Sister Manira called in and told us about how officials in Newark are being sued now because of the lead content, the high level of lead that has been found in the water in Newark. You know, just like in Flint, Philly, they had it as well. But now we're seeing it a lot more visible. One of the reasons why we're seeing it more visible is because with gentrification, it also brings about what these people call urban renewal. Some call it community development, et cetera, et cetera. But what's going on after they have allowed these buildings and so forth to become blighted and dilapidated? Now they're about demolishing a lot of them, rebuilding all around it, but they also have to change some of the other infrastructures that goes with it. Because remember, some of these places are, some of the stuff that they're doing is brand new or so highly renovated that, you know, they just gut it out or whatever and keep the actual structure, but everything else is, you know, brand new. Well, they knew that there was lead in these urban areas. They've known that for years. And again, you have to remember, these people tend to plan 50, sometimes 100 years in advance. As we begin to look at gentrification here in Philadelphia, that plan actually went into effect in the 1950s. And then come the 1960s, it went into fuller effect. They used the riots or the so-called rebellion as a way to further the plan that was already implemented, already put on the table in the 1950s. But then in the 1960s, after, again, the so-called riots occurred, they then used that in terms of they created these programs to do the renovation or whatever of communities then. This was all, again, to begin to put other things in place, which is what they did. And so now we have this next phase of things, and this is gentrification in a totally different way. It's not like white flight from before. This is totally different. With that said, they are literally taking the pipes out of the street, replacing those pipes. So now remember, a lot of the families that lived in some of these areas are now gone, meaning black folks, they're now gone. okay? The ones who did not leave for whatever reason on their own, the cities, of course, are able to deal with what they call eminent domain and get you out that way, you see. So now there will be little evidence of being, or not just little evidence, but the capability to actually respond to the illnesses, et cetera, that people have as a result of drinking water with this high level content of lead. Needless to say, also children that are now being diagnosed with all these various kinds of ailments, well, certainly research has shown that some of these things too have come from the contamination of the water. Again, bottom line, family, what are we going to do? It's so important that as we talk about some of the problems, that we also begin to focus more on what are some of the solutions. So with that said, again, we're going to begin to address some of those issues a bit more effectively. MWM is now establishing think tanks and also study groups. We're going to tell you a little bit more about that later on this week as well. But again, it's very, very important that we begin to put various things and operations in action, in motion. Before we go to the phone lines, and I want you all to share your thoughts about any of these things that are relevant to us as a people, particularly, again, we're talking about Black Power tonight. What, in your opinion, is Black Power? And more importantly, how can we now enact it to a greater extent, realistically? Now, of course, when we heard the clip from Chairman Fred Hampton, he talked about self-defense. Isn't it very interesting that there has been this real push to move toward, you know, what they call anti-violent programs? And again, not anti-violence when it comes to cops, although, you know, we see little rallies and other things that respond to when there's actual murder, you know, whatever. And, you know, what usually happens, that may go on for a few months, depending on, you know, how much coverage it gets. But then after it goes to court and the settlement occurs, you don't hear nothing at all, you see. So this idea of what we're told about anti-violent programs or, you know, this and that, who is that really for? What is that really about? Now, you know, on this program, we've had on several occasions Black folks that have come on and talked about their gun clubs or, you know, some other kinds of very up on board, you know, nothing that they're trying to sneak and do or anything like that. Everything's up on board, so-called legal, and so forth and so on. However, we now have to also begin to ask when it comes to sisters. How well are sisters really protected? If we're at a point now where, and again, we just got another report today that a body was found here in Philadelphia in a park, a young two-year-old. I think was missing since Monday. They found her today. Well, we're getting these kinds of reports every week from various cities. The question has to at some point come, what is going on? I mean, of course, our people are murdered and found dead all over the country often. But there seems right now, and it has been like this over the past 5 years in particular, the number of Black females, young girls, and older females has risen to a very alarming rate number. And yet we're not really hearing anything about it. Hopefully when we talk to Chairman Fred tonight, we will also go a little bit into that as well. Because Chicago, in the past year, the number of Black women that have been found dead in Chicago, one recently was found cut up, burnt, I think in a trunk or something. Point is, and then, of course, Sister Tawanda is giving us one almost every week for Maryland, missing or found dead. The point is, like Ya Asantewaa, and others, if we are not going to get the type of care or the type of protection that we feel we need to have, then we must begin to do it ourselves. So, again, later on this week, we're going to talk more about that, particularly as we begin to give you more insight into the Black Print 2020. Okay, we're going to go to our lines now and give you all the opportunity to share information that you may have, or if you have a comment or thought about something that I've already talked about or have played or you've heard, we certainly welcome you to share that with us. You could just press 1 now, and we will certainly bring you into the dialogue. Again, before we move forward, we want to remind you that Thursday, if you're here in Philadelphia, there will be a meeting, that's tomorrow, at the Free Library from 5:30 to 8:30. We start signing up our girls, our daughters. We call it Saving Our Daughters. It's part of our Little Sisters program. This is for girls from 7 to 17. This particular one, again, is from 7 to 17. And this is a way to begin to connect with our young girls in a way that will not only help to nurture them, but that will help to edify them, to know thyself, to be stronger, but also to connect to other sisters of similar and like minds, but also back to our communities, and with that, to strengthen our families. And so, again, we start that tomorrow. Again, 5:30, the registration, the sign-up for the Little Sisters program is from 5:30 to 6:30. And then after that, there is a general information meeting about some of the things that's going on with MWM, including the We Charge Genocide campaign. We are beginning now to formulate the We Charge Genocide committees, the task force committees nationwide, so that we can prepare to get the million signatures that we are looking to obtain to take to the United Nations by the end of 2020. Keeping in mind that this is what is known as the decade for African people, as declared by the United Nations. So what MWM has kind of prepared to do is to help provide information and education, particularly as it pertains to human rights. We have to educate our communities, our families, about these types of things. It can't just be civil rights anymore. It has to be human rights as well. This is what El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz told us 50 years ago, that we've now got to start looking at the issue of human rights more seriously, and as such, that has to be the call of the day, and certainly that day has not only come and gone, but nevertheless, we are now picking up the mantle and proceeding on with the work that has to be. Keeping in mind that in 1951, Paul Robeson, William Paterson, also started that process, taking the petition to the United Nations in 1951, and as such began to produce the documentation of the murders and the beatings and the lynchings that were occurring in this country routinely without any kind of punishment or what have you of those that were inflicting these crimes on our people. Again, Paul Robeson and William Paterson were whiteballed after doing this, and even had one had their passport taken. Well, we understand that we are going to come under fire for making this move to expose this government to a greater extent. That is the intention, and so, you know, we know that it goes with the territory, other stuff, but the point is that this will educate more of our people as well as to let other countries see that we are not afraid to raise this issue. We are also not just not afraid, but we are very adamant about making certain that we now document on a national level, not just what police and governmental terrorism is and has been. No, but we also are going to document the numbers or the data, the statistics as it pertains to homelessness, the informal education, also mass incarceration. All of these things are linked to genocide, ethnic cleansing. That, of course, gentrification is now also known as ethnic cleansing. The point being, when we look at the definition of human rights violations, crimes against humanity, certainly these things do fall in that scope. But it's up to us to bring it into the 21st century in a way where we can connect the dots so that we make it clear that the first draft in 1948 of the Declaration for Human Rights was one for that time period. And therefore, it focused on or addressed things as they were, which is what, you know, they should have happened, obviously. But now, we're in the 21st century. So what we will be conveying to the Human Rights Commission and other aspects of the United Nations, we are suggesting and proposing that a revision occurs for the Human Rights Declaration. Because we are in a time period now where the sophistication, the usage of power, for lack of a better word, and other things is very different. And we've seen that and can prove that. So now we have to assert it and make sure that these documents reflect the time that we're in. It's just like anything else. You have to look at the necessity to revise situations. And so this is one of the We Charge Genocide pieces that we will be introducing very soon. Again, next week there will be the press briefing and community information meeting. That's going to happen on October 25th, which I believe is next Thursday. We'll be at the Paul Robeson House, and that, of course, is at 50th and Walnut Street. And that meeting will start at 7 o'clock. So if you want more information about that or anything else that's relevant to MWM, A Million Black Women Rising, etc., you can just email us at nationalmwm@aol.com. Again, nationalmwm@aol.com. Okay, let me see. While we're waiting for Chairman Fred, let me see. This looks like, am I looking at Dr. Iya Adjua in queue here? If that's you, Dr. Iya Adjua, please press 1 now. I'd just like to get an update on what's going on with your book. And I think I recognize, yeah, there you go. Okay, all right. And so, family, for those who have never met our sister, Dr. Iya Adjua, of course, we're going to be bringing her in as we now, next week, we start unveiling our Black Homeschooling Network and some of the work that Sister Hattie and others are going to be doing to bring about, even though we have the Black Homeschooling Network that we're getting ready to put out there. We do have a what we call alternative education component, and that's for everyone. The Black homeschooling piece, of course, is for children, for the youth, but the alternative education edification program is for all of our people. And by the way, before we get ready to go to Dr. Iya Adjua, I did already send a letter to the president of the Black Clergy of Philadelphia. And what I am asking for the president of the Black Clergy of Philadelphia, I think there's a couple hundred members of that organization. These are people who have churches or mosques or whatever in Philadelphia. What we are asking, meaning MWM, is we are requesting a meeting with the president of the organization. We are also asking at that meeting that or offering to all of the churches the sessions that we want to bring to the church. One is for the national campaign for the elimination of violence and abuse of women and girls of African descent. We want to be able to have healing circles, information sessions, etc., with sisters at the church or the mosque or what have you. And so we are requesting that these various clergy people allow us to come and spend an hour or so with whomever might want to participate in getting information about, you know, how to prevent violence and abuse, how to, you know, deal with trauma, things of that nature. These are sessions that we are now prepared to offer. The other thing we'll be requesting of the Black clergy is their support for the We Charge Genocide campaign. We want them to be able to share the information with their congregation. And, of course, because we're looking at to obtain signatures, we would like for the congregational people to literally sign the petition. We have demands that we are introducing, and so we will also bring information to these churches or places of worship that helps people to learn more about human rights, what it is, what are crimes against humanity, etc. So the last thing that we are requesting from the churches or the places of worship is the possibility of utilizing their facilities, one of their rooms, for the alternative educational program, meaning to be in the community in a nearby location where anyone can come and get history, can get maybe GED, can get information on health, etc. You know, a lot of these churches do have rooms in their church, and so we are going to request to be able to maybe once a month utilize a space in their church that we will provide these informational, educational kinds of classes and sessions at their church and for the community. We sent that letter about a week ago, so we're still waiting for the response, and we're going to certainly keep you all posted on that. But this is what we're talking about now. These are the things that we're now doing, family. Again, there has to be some plans of action whereby we have to also begin to hold people accountable or more accountable in our communities. And so MWM has now created the kinds of operations to do that. We're going to document who we contact. We're going to document who responds. And again, the question will have to be raised at some point. If you have not responded or if you're denying the request, at some point the question will have to be asked why. So moving right along. When we say movement, we mean exactly that. Okay, we're going to go to our live line. And we're going to bring in our sister, Dr. E.I. Ajua. Of course, she is the doctor of African American Studies. And she has written a book. And so I would like to get an update on that. Greetings, my sister.
Hotep, sis. How are you?
My Hotep. Wonderful. Good to see you. Good to hear you.
Good to hear from you, too. I see you still working. Be making... You're a hardworking queen. We are blessed to have you on our side because you're a hard worker. I'll tell you. I was thinking about you and I said, oh, the sister is out here. She's still putting in that work because I need a visit from you, and I know I owe you some time as well. You know?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Well, we're ready now. I mean, I had to deal with some family issues over the past few months. But, you know,
that's right.
So, you know, so that has worked out pretty much now. So, you know, we're ready
excellent.
Last time we talked, you were doing a signing, I think. How did it go? Tell us about the book.
It went well. It was good. It was good. It went really well, and we had a good turnout, and you know, a lot of people bought the book after, and it was positive. It was really powerful. So the book is Act to Claim the Minds of African Youth, and it is about it is for adults and teachers, parents, elder elder siblings, anyone who is, not anyone, but most people who are teaching African children, preferably yeah. Africans who are teaching African children. And it encourages the educators to walk their talk, because you can expose our children to all the information in the world, but if they see you mm-hmm. doing something different from the information mm-hmm. that you're sharing with them, then they will dismiss the information. And so mm-hmm. in turn, I have created a model called the mm-hmm. African Cultural Consciousness Leadership Awareness Instructional Model. And it talks in that model of 7 steps to it that guides the educator and the parent. It's for the educator, the parent, and the student to, you know, guide them through the process. Like, what does that look like when a African-centered educator is sharing information with African youth? And what does that process mm-hmm. look like?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the gist of the book. And
okay.
It's going well. I'm selling, you know.
Do you have any more book signings coming up? Do you have any more book signings coming up?
Not that I planned.
Okay.
Like right now, I'm looking at different places to distribute the book. So that's where I'm at this point.
Okay, well, we have activated the M4 group, so we certainly would be more than happy to help with that. The M4 group is one of our business entities now, because, you know, we realize very clearly that we have to make sure we have our own, revenue streams going. And so we created this M4 component. We call it the M4 group. And what that represents is marketing, media, manufacturing, and merchandising. M4.
Excellent.
Okay.
Excellent.
We're providing those services now in those areas of things. And so we certainly will be more than happy to, you know, talk with you about that in terms of marketing, helping to further market your book.
Excellent. I look forward to the engagement. Yep. I look forward.
Yes. Yes.
The more exposure,
definitely.
The better. Yeah.
Definitely. But for right now, let folks know how they can get it.
Oh, good idea. You can get the book.
See, we're ready to get started right now.
Right? Yeah, you know, you can get the book at wehemimesu.com. That's wehemimesu.com. It's wehemimesu.com. I'm going to spell that again. wehemimesu.com, and it will tell you, once you go to that site, it will tell you how to get the book. But you could PayPal me. I'll take PayPal and Cash App for the book.
Okay.
And the book is
great.
The book is $25, and it's worth it.
All right. And so, Dr. Eob, when you get the opportunity, text me and or email me that information so that we could send that out, you know, send the link out and everything.
Okay, I definitely will do that.
Great. All right.
Wonderful. Yes, let me know where I can get in to sit in with what you're doing. You're doing so much. So let me know where I can fit in to assist.
Oh,
you know.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm glad you reminded me. On November the 5th, we haven't selected the location yet. I'm hoping it would be at Sister Clara Muhammad School. We haven't confirmed that yet. But on November the 5th, we'll be doing, I think it's the 5th and the 6th. I have to check to see.
Okay.
But we'll be doing one's going to be like a kind of town hall meeting, a village meeting, for lack of a better word. But then the other session is going to be focusing on the life and legacy of Sister Clara Muhammad. Okay.
Excellent.
That's her Earth Day. And she's also one of our sister saints.
Because yes. What people don't understand or realize is certain things, even though, you know, much props, of course, to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but at the same time, we have to also be very clear about the role that Sister Clara Muhammad played, too. And even in terms of introducing the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to Islam. But also, like Amy Jacks Garvey, when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was incarcerated, it was Sister Clara that kept things moving for the nation.
Okay.
And Amy Jacks Garvey, Mother Amy Jacks Garvey, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the part that we really wanted to focus on, Dr. E.I., do you know, and I know you probably know some parts of it, but again, by starting some of these projects, it really enables us to really go deeper into some of the research.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1950s, brothers and sisters were being arrested who were in the nation because they refused to send their children to school, public school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Okay,
a lot of them were literally arrested. Some literally went to jail because they refused to send their children to the white man. And so they started their own schools. And so I had wondered, I thought at first that the different schools, because you got Sister Clara Muhammad schools all over the country. And so initially I just thought that it was like a tribute, you know, to her because she was the mother of the nation. No, that's not just it. She literally started homeschooling programs for the nation in the 1950s.
Okay.
And they were very adamant about, and they were very adamant about that. They wouldn't. They refused. Just like folks were refusing to go into the army, into the service, they refused to send their children to them schools in the
1950s. That's powerful. That's what
is.
We need now. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that's why on the 5th, we're going to do that session again to provide the information, but also to pay tribute to her. And as we're now unveiling our Black Homeschooling Network, we're showing the examples of those that came before us, the work that they did. So we'll be highlighting her. We'll be highlighting Marva Collins in the Marva Collins way. We'll be highlighting Dr. Barbara Sizemore.
Yes,
who again?
Yes.
Oh, listen, we ain't playing.
Yes.
We ain't playing.
Yeah,
so those are some of the ancestors.
I know we got to throw in Anna Julia Cooper in there. You know?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely.
Wow.
We have to bring this information and this work forward. We've got to do that because, you know,
some of us
are familiar, but a lot of our people. That information is not being matriculated or not being made readily accessible. And so we're putting it in the forefront of our work because these are the examples of what has motivated and inspired us.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
and so now, so that's from the ancestral realm. But then, of course, for the present day, certainly Dr. Adelaide Stanford.
Yes.
Gotta do it. 100%. You gotta do it.
Wow.
So that's what's happening in November.
Good.
So when you say get in where you fit in, there you go.
Yeah. Okay.
There
yes,
you
indeed.
Go.
I'll
that's what
right
we're working
in.
On.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
All right.
Okay.
I'm excited about
it. Oh yeah. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Because you hear a lot of people talking about you know, the education system and this and our children aren't learning and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like,
right.
Okay, so what are we going to do?
Yeah,
what are
we
going
to
do?
Exactly. And we've been saying that for a long time, you know. We've been saying it for a long time.
I know. Before you go, I just want to ask this question because this was another analysis we kind of came up with. What do you feel is going on with these charter schools now?
I was just talking with this sis, and she's in Louisiana. And, you know, in Louisiana, they have this, like, they don't even have public schools anymore. All their schools, a majority of their schools are charter now. And,
right.
I think you're talking about the charter schools in Philly.
Yeah, we'll start with those.
I don't know what's going on with them outside of, I think that a lot of them that have started initially, that was not the plan. You know, the plan was mm-hmm. to have some, I think the plan was to be have some level of independence in terms mm-hmm. of how we were educating mm-hmm. our children. And
right.
Then the state stepped in. I talk about that in my book as well, how the state stepped in, and when they stepped in and started charting off our time, it became problematic in terms of
mm-hmm.
ritual and ceremony that we were doing with
mm-hmm.
the children, exposing them to information that, you know, cultural knowledge that they needed,
right.
and things of that sort. So
right.
all I can say is the state. And so as long as the state still has their hands in it, they're going to have some control. Even though the state is supposed to represent us, but we know too that the state makes more money off of incarcerating our family than they will off of educating us.
Right.
And so they're going to do what they can to make their money, because it's all about the profit for them. Control over black bodies is still in full effect.
Right, right. Well, you know, this is what we've kind of began to observe and put the pieces together. One, when there was a real effort to develop independent schools, and of course
mm-hmm.
many of them were struggling, the push for charter schools gave folk, you know, what appeared to have been the opportunity, the possibility to do what they wanted to do and not be as concerned about, you know, finances. So that was
mm-hmm.
the appeal, that they could get money. Here we go again with the money. They could get money
mm-hmm.
to operate, you know, their schools. So now,
mm-hmm.
so that happened. But what also happened was those that were serious that went into that process,
mm-hmm.
their information, right? Because a lot
mm-hmm.
of some of the teachers of course develop their own kinds of, you know, curriculum or materials or whatever. So what ended up happening was the system was able to better observe or better get that kind of information, because
mm-hmm.
those committed, dedicated teachers were, you know, they were using different techniques or different kinds of other kinds of things. And of course
mm-hmm.
the system was able to better observe that. Ultimately
right.
started fading them out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now here's where
mm-hmm.
it gets even more interesting. So now that has happened, now, again, it's just they were Philadelphia for right now, but I'm seeing it in other cities as well. What they're
mm-hmm.
now doing is putting the charter schools under private management.
Right, right.
Right?
Yeah. Which was probably the goal from the beginning.
That's
yeah.
right. Yep. That, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah.
So,
right
to now, that's right. See, this is very interesting. And like you said, or like we have talked about, some of these private entities also have links to prisons.
Mm. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So when we talk about the school-to-prison pipeline,
mm-hmm.
we are literally getting involved with entities that are, you know, that had these other sides to them.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
here's, you know, and so again, I'm saying, as a people, as a community, we're not really doing the kind of assessment or analogies on things. You know, I talked with a sister a couple of weeks ago, and I said to her, I said, you know, we don't have our own schools. And she said, yes, we do. Yes, we do. She said, she said, my son goes to Kenny Gamble School, Universal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I said, no, I said we don't have our own school. She said, yes, we do. That's our school. This is the kind of illusions and delusions that, you know, our people are now in. Because they think charter means that, okay, yeah, there does seem to be a tendency to have a little more leeway to do certain things, certainly. But if these people want to shut you down, they'll cut your funding off like that.
In a heartbeat. And we actually had a brother that, he wrote a book for charter schools, and I can't think of his name, but it's Kwame, I can't think of his last name, Kenyatta, I think. And he asked that question. He came and did a presentation, and he asked that question. He was like, what do you want to do when they decide to reroute the tax dollars? What do you want to do about it, you know? And, of course, that was also a question I asked in my research that I did. And, I mean, the answers that I received, they look good in writing, but I don't think that that's actually what would happen if it came to that. I don't think that they had anything else in place. There was nothing else in place.
Well, I think that one of the major things was to make certain that we would stop striving to have independent schools. They saw that even though people were struggling, there was still, the desire and the fight to try to do that. And I think they threw that in the mix so that people would go, oh, okay, this is a little easier. We can do this. And rather than to continue to, strive, people abandoned the idea of independent school and went into the charter thing. And you know, here's the part that I think we need to examine as a people, and that is we need to develop our own system, our own educational system. Because if in fact public school
I hear you when you put that emphasis on system. It's true.
That's right. Absolutely. Because we see that it's going into privatization. Well, if it goes into privatization, then where is it going?
So
why would we not? We got all of these folk nowadays that have all of the credentials, have the capability, have the skills, etc. Why wouldn't we not develop our own systems? Educational systems.
And you know, and the thing is that when you say those systems, like they already exist. Develop our own systems. They already exist. We just have to put them into action.
Right. Well, I tell you, as soon as the weather breaks again, I'm going to head out to Chicago because I want to meet with the brother over there, Marcus Klein.
Yes.
Family, if y'all ain't seen that brother's work, oh my goodness.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
A good brother, serious about his work, and he is humble too. Yes. Yeah.
You see, that's what we're talking about in terms of the educational system.
Yeah.
You know,
yes.
A whole way of teaching, a whole way of doing what we need to do the way we need to do it.
Right.
Wonderful example.
I hear you.
Yes. So that's what I have Sister Hattie working on since she's retired.
Okay.
I now have been looking at helping to, develop how we're going to proceed in developing our own types of educational, you know, approach, methodology, ideology, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of that is already there, but we want to put it in an even more kind of refined, for lack of a better word, format, so that when the time comes, you know, we can compete with whomever in terms of we being the manager of, you know, our school or something, at least have that capability in addition to our own, needless to say.
Very true. Very true. We have to make that, it's something that we have to make happen right now. Like, we are so,
absolutely,
you know, behind in having this, you know, making this happen. But we definitely need our own, like you said, system of education. We need to put it into action. There's no doubt about that.
Well, no, that's why I said that the lines are now drawn in the sand. And for those folks that be just talking stuff, it's exposure time. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
It is time now that we have to show what we're talking about. It has got to now manifest.
That's right.
You know, next year there's going to be a lot of hoopla in the commemoration of the first ancestors being brought here by the English, under the peculiar or for the peculiar institution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Next year marks the commemoration. So next year we'll be kicking off our We Charge Genocide campaign with the signatures.
Good timing, excellent timing.
Absolutely.
Excellent timing. I know that's right. That's excellent timing. That's right.
See, that's what we're talking about.
We're going to need an alternative. We're definitely going to need an alternative. Because you know it's going to be even some of us that are out there, that are going to be out there celebrating our enslavement.
Absolutely.
Like, that, they're going to be out there doing that, you know?
Yep.
It's messed up
yep.
in more
we
ways
know.
Than one.
We
it's
know. We know.
Never lie.
Well, we're getting ready, my sister. No doubt about it. Okay, I've been trying to wait for Chairman Fried. I know he was in a meeting, so he probably still is, family. We may have to reschedule him for tomorrow because we're going to be doing special editions every day this week. And so we will be doing every day this week, leading up to our anniversary for next week. And, of course, as I said, we're going to be over at the Paul Robeson House on the 25th to do our 21. So we'll be doing a broadcast every day. Yes, we will.
Y'all going to be, Paul Robeson House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll be sending out the email later on tomorrow, I think it is. And we're going to do like a mini kind of press briefing because we want to start getting the information circulated about the We Charge Genocide campaign. And, we have a really interesting strategy because, again, we don't want to be like most and just say sign the petition. We don't do that. We'll be literally going into communities, educating our people about what human rights is. So we're already scheduled to go to New Orleans. We'll be going to Memphis. We're going to California, Detroit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're already scheduled to go.
Starting next week,
it'll be online, and also we'll be emailing them out.
Okay. Online where?
Okay. We'll have a website up.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. I will wait. I definitely want to get signatures, and I want to sign.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. This is going to be not only historic, but, you know, again, I don't know if you ever heard me mention the relationship to Paul Robeson and William Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
1951, Paul Robeson and William Patterson took the We Charge Genocide petition to the United Nations in 1951.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
And so
you
there's
know,
a book.
I was looking at, I have a book on Pan-African thought, and it starts mm-hmm. out with the date of 1787. And so I said, you know, I'm sure if that was happening in 1787 and there's record of it, then that
right.
thought, those ideas were happening way before then, you know? So I definitely venture to say with 100% confidence that as soon as our ancestors set foot on this land, that we were having thoughts of freedom. And even before then, you know?
Even absolutely.
Right, because what they had, the what is it called, the trails with the sharks used to, the sharks would eat the bodies of our ancestors that jumped overboard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's real.
Yep.
That's real. That's, you really wanted your freedom. They really wanted freedom.
Yep. Absolutely.
And so we owe them, you know, we owe them. They sacrificed their whole bodies, you know, and their minds and souls for us. So we owe, we definitely owe them. Yeah.
Well, we're certainly going to do our part, that's for sure.
I know that.
Cannot, as the saying goes, and I think it was Baba Kwame Ture, we must not fail our ancestors.
That's right.
Okay, we must not fail. You know, and speaking of the 1800s, the other thing I want to mention before we close out is that for whatever reason, you have some today who don't want to talk about the issue or be a part of the movement or work as it pertains to reparations. So when we developed the We Charge Genocide 21 project, we kind of, you know, kept that all in mind, you know, because we don't want to alienate anyone unnecessarily. So what we were able to do, Dr. Aya, was to really, as we look at the language that we're using, we also put other language in. And it's interesting that you mentioned the 1800s, because one of the kinds of phrases that we've incorporated in our documents is ex-slave compensation, you see. As a sense, you got some who don't want to, they don't like the word reparation. Okay, let's deal with ex-slave compensation.
Okay.
Right? And that came out of the 1800s. That was Mother Callie House.
Callie
right?
House. I'm looking right at her.
There you go.
Right now. Yep.
That's right.
My face
absolutely.
Is true. That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Is she a saint too? Let her be a saint too.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
She and Queen Mother Moore.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Yes. So, definitely. You know, so we, but again, you know, going back to what we were saying earlier, we must not fail our ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
We must
not.
If we do that,
not.
We will be failing ourselves and our
mm-hmm.
children, you know, so. It's all good. Well, my sister, I thank you for coming in and having this conversation with me. I was trying to wait for Chairman Fred, but I know that they're really, they're down almost to the wire. The house goes up for sale, I believe, it's October 23rd. So I think that's like maybe Monday or something like that coming up. So,
really?
You know,
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I know we're going to get him in this week, because that's one of the things we've been working on is, you know, making sure that he gets radio time and TV time and so forth to get this message put out there. But when I talked to him earlier, they were in the meeting. So we probably have to wait and get him in tomorrow night. But again, for those who want information, I do have some written information for you that you can look at in the meantime. If you just email me at nationalmwm@aol.com, I will send you a kind of overview of what it is that is happening with the house. We're talking about Chairman Fred Hampton Jr.'s house, which, of course, was the house of his grandparents, his father, you know, it's the family home. That his father grew up in, and his grandfather, I mean, his grandparents owned. Somehow, to make a long story short, when the grandparents passed, they gave it to
one of the sons, Chairman Fred Hampton Sr.'s brother. And mm-hmm. it wasn't until his passing last year that the house went to Chairman Fred.
Oh,
apparently,
okay.
Mm-hmm, yeah, apparently, though, the uncle didn't pay the taxes.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Wow. So I know yep. they jumped right in there.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they jumped right in there to yep. take it, huh? Wow.
Right, exactly.
So okay. is he doing any, is it too late or... Is he trying
well,
to,
that's what, yeah, that's why we were trying to get him on tonight, and I'm almost pretty sure we'll get him on tomorrow. I don't believe he has another meeting tomorrow, at least not for this time. But, yeah, they you know, it can be saved, but he has to raise X amount of dollars, like ASAP. It goes up for sale on, I believe it's the 23rd.
Next yep. week, okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm going to look on his page. I'm sure he got some information. I could maybe...
Oh, okay. And what I'll also
yeah.
do is I'll send you something to... I'll text you something as well.
Okay.
Okay.
Excellent. Excellent.
All right. All right, family. I'm going to try one more time. I've been trying to get reach him while we were talking, Dr. E.I., but he's not picking up. But when I talked to him earlier, I knew that he was in a meeting. But the meeting has probably run over. So I'm going to try just one more time, though. Hopefully we can get through. And if not, well, he'll definitely come in before the week is out, preferably tomorrow. But it is kind of an emergency situation.
Yeah.
You know, that has needs to stay in the family. It really does. Okay, yeah, he's still not picking up. Okay, so what we're going to do is end this session. Dr. E.I. Ajua, I thank you so much for coming in and filling in for us.
Very welcome. Anytime. Send me that information, sis, so I could get with you, and then we need to do some reciprocal work.
Absolutely. Yep, you
yeah,
will be
definitely.
Getting that very, very shortly. All right, family, we are going to leave you all as we oftentimes greet you, and that is in the spirit of Ma'at and Hotep. We've been talking with our sister, Dr. E.I. Ajua, and of course, we encourage you to get that book. Listen, some of our people are so talented, and not just talented, but extremely committed. Now, see, now when you got that combination, now you're
mm-hmm.
talking about something, okay? It's
right.
one thing to have skill and talent, but when you put that with commitment, that's
mm-hmm.
a whole nother kind of black power. All right, family. So we're going to leave you again. You know what we say here at New Day. We know we want peace. I mean, we definitely want peace. And we're going to get it at some point. However, with the way things are right now, unfortunately, we don't have that luxury. And I know there's a lot of times people, they don't want to get, you know, in caught up in some of the real stuff. They just want to, you know, act like it's not going on. Well, for those that can do that, and that's what you feel comfortable with, by all means do that. But for those of you who no, you must do more. You must stand up. You must fight back. You must deal with resistance. Well, we're here for you in particular. And
mm-hmm.
so with that said, you know, and Dr. E.I., you know what we say. If there's no justice, what?
No peace.
No peace. No peace.
That's right.
All right,
no
family.
Peace.
We're going to close out as we started with El Haj Malik El Shabazz, and he talked about the house Negro. Well, this time we're going to talk a little bit about the Ballad of the Bullet, because next month we're going to have a candidates night here in Philly. I'm going to tell you about that later on this week, and not because we're so interested in the candidates. Oh, no, no, no. We're getting ready to introduce the Million Woman Party. We're going to show you how we're going to rock that. That's next week. Till next time, family, we love you all. Remember, from Moja to the Shinda, together we shall win.
Friend. that I see from you to me. I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
We know y'all out there.
I want to talk about the ballot or the bullet. The ballot or the bullet explains itself. But before we get into it, since this is the year of the ballot or the bullet, I would like to clarify some things that refer to me personally, concerning my own personal position. I'm still a Muslim. That is, my religion is still Islam. My religion is still Islam. I still credit Mr. Muhammad for what I know and what I am. He's the one who opened my eyes. At present, I'm the minister of the newly founded Muslim Mosque Incorporated, which has its offices in the Teresa Hotel, right in the heart of Harlem. That's the Black Belt in New York City. And when we realize that Adam Clayton Powell is a Christian minister, he has Abyssinia Baptist Church, but at the same time, he's more famous for his political struggling. And Dr. King is a Christian minister in Atlanta, Georgia, but he's become more famous for being involved in the civil rights struggle. There's another in New York, Reverend Galamison. I don't know if you've heard of him out here. He's a Christian minister from Brooklyn, but has become famous for his fight against the segregated school system in Brooklyn. Reverend Cleve, right here, is a Christian minister here in Detroit. He's the head of the Freedom Now Party. All of these are Christian ministers. All of these are Christian ministers, but they don't come to us as Christian ministers. They come to us as fighters in some other category. I'm a Muslim minister. The same as they are Christian ministers, I'm a Muslim minister. And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a Black nationalist freedom fighter. Islam is my religion, but I believe my religion is my personal business. It governs my personal life, my personal morals. And my religious philosophy is personal between me and the God in whom I believe, just as the religious philosophy of these others is between them and the God in whom they believe. And this is best this way. Were we to come out here discussing religion, we'd have too many differences from the outset, and we could never get together. So today, though Islam is my religious philosophy, my political, economic, and social philosophy is Black nationalism. If we bring up religion, we'll have differences, we'll have arguments, we'll never be able to get together. But if we keep our religion at home, keep our religion in the club, keep our religion between ourselves and our God, but when we come out here, we have a fight that's common to all of us against the enemy who is common to all of us. The political philosophy of Black nationalism only means that the Black man should control the politics and the politicians in his own community. The time when white people can come in our community and get us to vote for them so that they can be our political leaders and tell us what to do and what not to do is long gone. Okay. By the same token, the time when that same white man, knowing that your eyes are too far open, can send another Negro into the community, get you and me to support him so he can use him to lead us astray, those days are long gone. The political philosophy of black nationalism only means that if you and I are going to live in a black community, and that's where we're going to live, because as soon as you move into one of their, as soon as you move out of the black community into their community, it's mixed for a period of time, but they're gone, and you're right there all by yourself. We must understand the politics of our community, and we must know what politics is supposed to produce. We must know what politics play in our lives. And until we become politically mature, we will always be misled, led astray, or deceived, or maneuvered into supporting someone politically who doesn't have the good of our community at heart. So the political philosophy of black nationalism only means that we will have to carry on a program, a political program of re-education, to open our people's eyes, make us become more politically conscious, politically mature. And then we will, whenever we get ready to cast our ballot, that ballot will be cast for a man of the community who has the good of the community at heart. And the economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we should own and operate and control the economy of our community. You would never, you can't open up a black store in a white community. White man won't even patronize you. And he's not wrong. He got sense enough to look out for himself. And you don't have sense enough to look out for yourself. The white man is too intelligent to let someone else come and gain control of the economy of his community. But you will let anybody come in and control the economy of your community. Control the housing, control the education, control the jobs, control the businesses under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer. The community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man. The man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you're running down yourself if you take it out. And you and I are in a double trap, because not only do we lose by taking our money someplace else and spending it, when we try and spend it in our own community, we're trapped because we haven't had sense enough to set up stores and control the businesses of our community. The man who's controlling the stores in our community is a man who doesn't look like we do. He's a man who doesn't even live in the community. So you and I, even when we try and spend our money in the block where we live or the area where we live, we're spending it with a man who, when the sun goes down, takes that basket full of money in another part of the town. So we're trapped, double trapped, triple trapped. Anywhere we go, we find that we're trapped. And every kind of solution that someone comes up with is just another trap. But the political and economic philosophy of black nationalism, the economic philosophy of black nationalism shows our people the importance of setting up these little stores and developing them and expanding them into larger operations. Woolworth didn't start out big like they are today. They started out with a dime store and expanded and expanded and expanded until today they're all over the country and all over the world, and they're getting some of everybody's money. Now, this, what you and I in General Motors, the same way it started out like it is, it started out just a little rat race type operation. And it expanded and expanded until today is where it is right now. And you and I have to make a start. And the best place to start is right in the community where we live. So our people not only have to be re-educated to the importance.